You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. An NFL star apologizes for comments he made about disrespecting the flag, and an NBA broadcaster resigns after tweeting "All Lives Matter." Our guest says there's a better way to make those comments about race. We'll talk about how to have those tough conversations coming up. First, while we are not on quite as strict a lockdown as we were a couple of months ago, there are still concerns about the ability to move around and stay safe and healthy. So many of us are still making the most of at-home activities. And for a lot of people, that means more time for reading. It can be a nice way to escape a bit, and can also be a way to help make sense of the world that we're living in. We were lucky to have Ann Patchett join us early on in the stay-at-home order period. She's a best-selling author of several books, including her latest, The Dutch House. She's also co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. She was with us to talk about how books can help us during a time like this and to make some recommendations. We thought it was a conversation worth revisiting.
I imagine you're a pretty big reader in any time, but what does reading mean for you right about now, with a lot of difficulties, including, of course, changes at your own bookstore?
Well, yes. It's funny because at first I had a hard time reading, which is just like not ever a problem for me. And I've talked to so many people who've said that, had a hard time concentrating, was really digging to look and find the right book. So that's part of it. And then, of course, I'm always reading for the bookstore. And like so many independent bookstores, we are still shipping. So we're not open to the public, but you can email in your orders. So find your local independent bookstore and keep them alive.
What did you do to find that right book for you for the right moment, maybe after that initial period of having a hard time keying in on something?
Well, my thing is I'm always reading books that haven't come out yet. I read galleys because everybody sends me 5 books every single day of my life. And I kept trying to read the way I always read, which is to be looking forward and reading things new. And what I realized is that there was a big part of me that just wanted to go backwards and read some things I'd already read before, read some things that were comforting to me. And once I did that, I really got my groove back.
Comfort reading. I love that. What stood out to you when it came to comfort reading?
Well, actually, the thing that I really desperately wanted to read was not so comforting. And that's Katherine Ann Porter's Pale Horse, Pale Rider, which is a novella. If you get any collection of Katherine Ann Porter, you'll find it. But it is the greatest pandemic story ever written, and it's about the Spanish flu in 1918. And it's something that I've read several times over the years. And, you know, it's tough, it's emotional. But weirdly, that was my breakthrough. And going back and reading that really helped. I also went back and read David Copperfield again, because nobody can resist David Copperfield. It just pulls you in. And no matter how much you don't have concentration, you're going to have a good time reading David Copperfield.
Now, you wrote a piece for The New York Times about why we need life-changing books right now. What do you mean by life-changing books?
Well, the piece that I wrote was about Kate DiCamillo, and that reading Kate DiCamillo was really life-changing for me. I don't have children, and I don't tend to read children's literature. I don't read middle grade books. And about a year and a half ago, I read all of Kate DiCamillo's books. I met her. People kept telling me how great she was, what a great writer she was. I knew that she had read all of my books, and I thought, I've just got to do this. And I was only going to read one or two, and I couldn't stop. And that was a great thing to think about right now, because if you don't have the bandwidth to read a full grown-up novel, read a middle grade novel. And I really, really recommend the novels of Kate DiCamillo, The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane, The Magician's Elephant, Tales of Despero. They're spectacular books, and you can have a complete reading experience in 2 hours. And she's really like the E.B. White of our time. She is as good as it gets.
Is there anything more fun, Anne, than finding a book you like by an author and then realizing there's a whole bunch of other stuff they wrote? Like, you're set for, you know, months, years maybe with them?
It's the best. It is absolutely the best. And then there's the experience of having an author like that who you've been reading all along, and then their new book comes out and you think this is the best. So one of my favorite authors is Louise Erdrich, and she has a new book that came out last month called The Night Watchman. And it is, for my money, the very best Louise Erdrich book. So I think that Louise Erdrich is probably the best novelist, and now we have her best book. So that's incredibly exciting.
Ann Patchett is with us to share some great reads. She's written many books of her own. Her latest is The Dutch House. You mentioned Pale Horse, Pale Rider. You had, I think, a blog post, or maybe it was on your bookstore site, with some other novels related to a disease and pandemic, if that's where people want to go right now. Not everybody will, but what are some other ones we might reach for?
Well, of course, everybody's talking about Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, which was a fantastic pandemic novel. There's The Stand by Stephen King. If, you know, you've got time to read 1,000 pages right now. But I got to say, in my own experience, more and more, I want to find something that's going to make me feel a little better. And one book that I love, especially for Wisconsin, Jane Hamilton's The Excellent Lombards, which has got to be the great Wisconsin novel. So definitely your listeners should be looking for that. Writers and Lovers by Lily King. Just a very, very hopeful, engaging, one of those books you can't put down, does your heart good. Those are the kinds of things that I'm looking for right now. I mean, I'm not saying necessarily everything is happy, but everything feels very normal. I just started Ann Tyler's new book, Redhead by the Side of the Road, last night. And I thought, yeah, you know, Ann Tyler, she knows what she's doing. You feel very taken care of when you're reading an Ann Tyler book. Not so much when you're reading a Stephen King book.
Fair. Yeah. Yeah, you feel kind of bad about things. Well, I guess when you read Stephen King, you always realize that things could always be worse than they are.
So much worse. Exactly. What are you reading?
Oh, well, I've got a couple of things going. I just started, I'm late to the game. I'm always late on cool stuff. Bone Season, The Bone Season by Samantha Shannon. I'm only a couple chapters into that so far.
Yeah.
I just read Phil Rickman. He has this series of mysteries set on the Welsh-English border with vicar, Merrily Watkins.
Those are fantastic. And boy, mysteries are a great thing to dive into right now. It's almost like working a jigsaw puzzle. You know, you're engaged and you're on edge and calm at the same time. That's a great suggestion.
That's a great analogy. We actually just talked to a couple of people about why jigsaw puzzles are so huge. Like, you can't buy them now. They're sold out. Our minds want something to latch out and solve. And I guess a mystery novel might scratch that same itch.
It's very true. And a lot of bookstores, including Parnassus Books in Nashville, we have amazing jigsaw puzzles. We just got in. It's almost like, you know, we bought up all the toilet paper. No, we bought up all the jigsaw puzzles.
Do you do jigsaw puzzles yourself, or do you have time with all the books you have to read?
You know, jigsaw puzzles to me are very social. So if I have other people around, I'd really enjoy a jigsaw puzzle. It's not something I'm going to sit down and do by myself.
We're listening back to a conversation Central Time host Rob Ferret had with the author Ann Patchett a couple months ago. She's the author of several books, including Bel Canto and her most recent, The Dutch House. She also co-owns the bookstore Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. We talked all about reading, what comfort it provides, and what to read. And great news, we've compiled Ann's recommendations, and you can find that list at WPR.org/Central Time or on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What about you? What have you found yourself reading recently? Have you been surprised by a book? What would you recommend to others who are looking to get lost in a really good book right now? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up that conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're listening back to a recent conversation between Central Time host Rob Ferret and best-selling author Ann Patchett. She co-owns Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee, and she shared her reading recommendations with us and talked about how her reading habits have changed with the coronavirus pandemic. You can find an article listing her recommendations over at WPR.org/Central Time or on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we want to hear from you. Has reading been a way to entertain or comfort yourself during this time? What have you been reading? Were you too distracted to read much in the early weeks of the pandemic? And has that changed at all now that we're a few months in? And we'd love to have you give us a book recommendation. Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR and let us know.
Let's go to your calls now. Josh starts us off in Madison. Josh, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you got for us, Josh?
Oh, well, ever since high school, I read this book first in high school, and then after I got out of high school and college, I actually read it two more times, and that book is called The Odyssey, and I'm sure people are familiar with it, but it's a very good book, and it takes your mind off a lot of things, and there's several different stories in that book that are very interesting and kind of keeps you on the edge of your seat, and there's some humor in it, too. But currently I am a fourth year plumbing apprentice for the state of Wisconsin. So the main book that I always, you know, have my nose in is that Wisconsin State Plumbing Code book. But when I have time to, you know, take a break from the lawyer gibberish of shall and shall not and stuff like that, that's in the code book, The Odyssey is a good book to read. Also, Shiloh is an awesome book to read. And then a lot of people think this is funny, but I say The Dictionary is a good book to read also.
Really?
Just because the power of words is so unbelievably, I can't even explain the power of words, how powerful words are. But to actually know the definition of words, and then when I see them, whether they're in the code book or they're on a sign or, you know, something else that I'm reading, I just, it clicks back and I remember, oh, I read that in the dictionary. I know what that word means.
Fantastic. Josh, thanks so much, Anne.
I love that. Okay. And I actually read the dictionary too. I'm all for that. But let me say something about The Odyssey. Two things. One, really fun to look at different translations. So, you know, reading one translation of The Odyssey is entirely different from reading another translation. But the book that I would really recommend is called Circe by Madeline Miller, which came out a couple of years ago. It was a huge hit, and it is a retelling of the Odyssey from the point of view of Circe, the witch, who is the one who turns Odysseus and his men into pigs. And it's a fantastic book.
Thank you so much for that call. I appreciate it. Great recommendations. We'll go to Nancy in Milwaukee now. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I heard your guest say that she felt she needed something at this time to pick her up. And what I'm going to say is not probably going to do that. but what I recently reread three of Marilyn French's books, which were written in the late 70s, maybe going into the 80s. And I feel there should be a necessity for every woman to read at this time, because it shows that, concerning how long ago they were written, women's progress in life has not really improved much. And all of that was borne out by all of these recent sexual escapades by various men. I just feel what Marilyn had to say. She's been dead for a long time, but I really feel that what she had to say and her hopefulness about women's lives has not actually come to pass, certainly as fast as she would have desired.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. So some social commentary there, Anne.
Okay, and I certainly remember reading The Women's Room when it came out, and I've been a big fan of Marilyn French, and I have a book that would be perfect for that caller. It's a first novel called Valentine by Elizabeth Wetmore, and it takes place in Texas in 1976. And it really is exactly what you're talking about, except in a novel. And it's a look back on how the situation both has and has not changed for women and how women are judged and believed over time. Fantastic first novel, Valentine.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. Talking to author Ann Patchett about great book recommendations for a time of safer at home orders around the country. Back to your calls now. Dale is on the line in River Falls. Dale, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A great, great topic. Say, I heard your comment earlier talking about The Stand, and that was actually going to be my first recommendation, but for a very different reason. In general, I've found my my mind going towards a different style of reading for the past probably 5-6 years or so. And it's less about going from cover to cover. It's really more about reading, like, history, for example, where you can jump in and you can read just a section at a time. And what I love about The Stand, actually, is, yes, it can seem like it's quite a tome and quite an undertaking, but because I've read it before, I can go back and remember that it is also a story about good triumphing over evil. So I found comfort in reading just even the human experience about how people were kind of relating with one another. But also the second thing that I mentioned was that I also find myself gravitating toward not only kind of comfort books that I've read before, but short stories, because I find that it's great, such as even picking up Khalil Gibran, for example, because being able to change a channel for even just 10 minutes or a half hour at a time and talking about changing the channel. We also thought it was funny last night that we noticed that I've gravitated towards our rocking chair and pulling it out with my back to the TV, but that actually has been very calming for me as well. I mean, the actual physical act of turning off, we were so just inundated with so much information right now. So,
wow, a lot to work with there. Anne, where do you want to start?
I've got two great recommendations. One, I'm so glad you brought up short stories, and you're absolutely right. This is a perfect time for short stories. In the same way that it's a perfect time for middle grade novels, just things that are more manageable. My favorite book of short stories that's come out in ages is by Kevin Wilson, and it's called Baby, You're Gonna Be Mine. Brilliant, amazing collection of short stories. And also on the history front, I'm a big Doris Kearns Goodwin fan, and she came out with a book last year called Leadership in Turbulent Times, and it's about how five different presidents became leaders. It's Lincoln and FDR and Roosevelt and Johnson, and I'm missing one. But anyway, it's exactly that. It's a book that you can pick up and you can skip around in, and it's just the highlights of the presidency and of the history in these different times. Fantastic book.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to, we got full phone lines, by the way. We could probably talk book recommendations all day. Pam joins us now in Fenimore. Pam, hi.
Hi there. When the idea of a lockdown became imminent, I went to the library and checked out the Jan Karen books, the Mitford series.
Mm-hmm.
And I am rereading them because I didn't want to read something that had a lot of strife or conflict in it. And I knew that, to me, these are comforting books. And I really enjoy it. There's a little bit of religious overtone, which is fine. But I wonder if there are any other authors out there that have a similar style of writing to Jan Karen.
Ooh, I wasn't familiar with Jan Karen, Anne.
I am familiar with Jan Karen, and I am trying to think of who would be a good comparable for her. Because there's a real sweetness and a gentleness. You know, you might want to go back to the early novels of Anne Tyler. I think that would be really good. And this is so crazy. But whenever I think of Jan Karen, I think of one of my favorite authors, who is Nancy Mitford, who has, it's just the word Mitford, and people get them confused all the time. The Mitford novels and a woman whose last name is actually Mitford. But Love in a Cold Climate and In Pursuit of Love by Nancy Mitford, two of the most enjoyable novels ever. It's like reading Jane Austen, but a little more contemporary. They're a very little bit more contemporary. They're set in England between the Great World Wars.
Thanks for the call. Hope those recommendations help. We'll go to John now in Wyota. John, hi.
Hi. I just have a quick suggestion. If you would like something local, local historical fiction would be August Derleth and the Sauk Prairie series, Sauk Prairie Saga. He's Wisconsin's most prolific writer, and these novels are written back in the 30s and 40s, and I think they're wonderful. There's probably 9 of them, and it's just great historical fiction, and I'd like to throw that out there.
And, John, I know August Derleth is known in part for his connection with H.P. Lovecraft horror-type stuff. This is not that. This is a whole other side of August Derleth, it sounds like.
Correct. This is historical fiction. It's not horror. It's not macabre. It's not poetry, which he wrote all of those things. And no, I really enjoy it. There's Bright Journey. There still is a summer night. There's Endless is the River. And there's several of them. The Edge
I
of
love
night.
That, John. Thanks a lot. And I love that idea of finding some local historical fiction.
Absolutely. That is great. And that one is completely new to me. So I'm taking notes while I'm listening. I feel like I'm on a book game show.
It kind of, yeah. Have you read? And you've read a lot more than I have, obviously. So you're winning.
Well, you're,
I give
you're
you
doing
more
a very good
so far.
Job.
Well, and I wanted to talk a little bit about audiobooks. That's something I do.
Yeah.
No, I'm doing other stuff. I just got an installment of N.K. Jemisin book, The 100,000 Kingdoms. I'm just about done with that on audiobook now. Is that something you reach for at all?
It is. I love audiobooks. I used to only listen to audiobooks if I was going on a long drive, which I think is how most of us think about it. Now, if I'm cooking dinner, if I'm cleaning the house, if I'm going for a walk, I'm listening to an audiobook. And not to be self-promoting, but I got to tell you, the best audiobook is The Dutch House, because Tom Hanks reads the audio of The Dutch House, and it is so spectacular. It just takes my breath away. Yeah.
Not just because you wrote it.
Because of him. He's amazing.
And thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been a blast. Thanks so much, everybody. Keep reading.
That was Central Time host Rob Ferret talking with Anne Patchett. She's a best-selling author of several books, including her latest, The Dutch House. We talked with her in April about what she was reading in the early weeks of the pandemic. And you can find an article listing her recommendations over at WPR.org/Central Time or on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up in the wake of George Floyd's death, we'll look at how we talk about race and how we can have more productive conversations. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 8 on The Morning Show, for a special hour for kids, Keely Boltina talks with Mick Sullivan, creator and host of the Kids History podcast, The Past and the Curious. That's tomorrow morning at 8, right here on the Ideas Network. Last week, New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees drew heavy criticism for his comments about kneeling during the national anthem. In an interview with Yahoo Finance, Brees said he will, quote, never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America. He also said while he's all for racial equality and justice, he stands with his grandfathers who fought in World War II. Kneeling has become a form of protest of police brutality against minorities. Brees' comments didn't sit well with a number of athletes, including Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers, who said the protests never had anything to do with the flag. Brees has since apologized a number of times, saying he's sensitive to the issue and has vowed to be part of the solution. While his apologies has been welcomed by some, others are saying he shouldn't have apologized in the first place. And he's the only high-profile figure to find himself in this situation. Our guest says there's a better way to talk about race. Tina Harris is a professor and endowed chair of race, media, and cultural literacy in the Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. Tina, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're glad you're here with us. Since you're there in Louisiana, let's start with Brees. What did you make of the whole situation, his comments about the flag and then the backlash and his apologies?
When I initially heard his comment, I was I definitely wasn't surprised, because I've heard many public figures, you know, say that they are against or not supportive of athletes who are kneeling and protesting, and they see it as an issue of patriotism. And I was kind of, I guess you could say, taken aback when he apologized. So he was very adamant. If you watch the first clip, not the first clip, but the coverage of his first statement, his more recent statement, he made it quite clear that he would never change his opinion about the issue. And then within 24 hours, he changed his opinion. And so
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, so that was fairly quick for him to change his mind. And it just, it seemed unauthentic or inauthentic to me, that it was probably, I don't know his heart, but it just seemed like it might be something political that he's doing in terms of wanting to present himself in the public eye in a certain way.
Well, here's a clip from one of Breeze's apologies. This was posted on his Instagram account.
I wish I would have laid out what was on my heart in regards to the George Floyd murder, Ahmaud Arbery, the years and years of social injustice, police brutality, and the need for so much reform and change in regards to legislation and so many other things to bring equality to our Black communities. I am sorry, and I will do better, and I will be part of the solution, and I am your ally.
What stands out to you about that apology?
What stands out to me is that he does acknowledge or recognize that he should have, he said, spoken from his heart, and he does seem to be very reflective about his initial stance and where he is right now. This also brings to light, it struck me that his apology is, I don't want to say it's in keeping with, but it just makes me think of other people in, I guess you could say, there's some individuals who will, they're not necessarily apologizing for the perception of kneeling and patriotism, but there's a transgression that's been committed against African Americans or other marginalized groups on a public platform, and then those individuals seem to be going on an apology tour where it seems as though their apology is strategic, and it might be insincere. I'm not saying that he's not sincere, but because we've seen so many apologies, not just recently, but throughout history, where people will apologize for a racial transgression, and it should be more about the change in the individual, like what's going on that's prompting this change. Your actions speak louder than words.
And Breeze was specifically asked about kneeling. Had he not made these comments so close to the death of George Floyd, do you think the response would have been as strong, or might it have been different?
I don't think the responses would have been as strong, but I still do think that people would have been rejecting his apology, because we've heard a lot of people apologize for their way of thinking, their behavior, their judgment of African Americans in various situations, and it's almost as if a person is apologizing not for offending someone, but apologizing for their behavior. Let me clarify that. So they may be apologizing and saying, "I'm sorry that you found my behavior offensive," as opposed to, "I'm sorry, I just did not know, or I didn't take the time to be more knowledgeable," if that makes sense.
We're talking with Tina Harris right now. She's a professor and endowed chair of race, media, and cultural literacy in the Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. And we're talking about some high-profile comments and pushback, and then often apologies, that have been happening in the wake of the George Floyd killing at the hands of Minneapolis police. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones. And Steve in Sun Prairie is up. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I listened to Colin Kaepernick's complete interview where we started the discussion at his locker. I listened to the thing about four or five times. The reason why he's kneeling and what he's saying is the country is not worthy of respect. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay if that's what his belief is, the country is not worthy of respect, that's why I'm kneeling. Don't lie to me and tell me what you're doing is respectful. It is disrespectful by definition. I take him at his word, so anyone that tells me otherwise is full of it.
All right, thanks for that, Steve. And Tina, would you like to respond to that?
Well, that was loaded. I guess I could say that in response to that, the kneeling is representative of the anguish, the frustration that African Americans are having in this country, not just in this moment, but we've had this for quite some time. And I think we are currently at our boiling point because no matter what kind of resistance we have engaged in, that has failed to get people's attention to recognize that there are a lot of injustices that are going on in the country. And I understand that people, they have their perceptions about what the kneeling means and patriotism, but what people really should be directing their attention to is the number of African Americans that are being killed, in police custody.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, so that's what the bottom line is that this is about senseless death for, fairly innocent infractions. I mean, some people are not even, breaking the law. The young lady, Breonna Taylor, was in her home and was shot 8 times by police. She was asleep in her bed. And so the purpose is to bring attention to these social justice issues. And yes, patriotism is important. I'm proud to be a U.S. citizen. But at the same time, I'm also African American, and I understand what it's like to live in a country, where you feel devalued at every level.
We're talking about how to talk about race with Tina Harris. She's a professor and endowed chair of race, media, and cultural literacy in the Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Drew Brees' apology, or do you think he should have stood by his original comment about kneeling during the national anthem? How do you feel when someone says all lives matter? Do you find it hard to talk about race because you're worried about saying something deemed offensive? Or maybe you genuinely want to avoid being offensive unintentionally. How frustrating is it when you hear somebody say something that is racially insensitive? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our discussion on how to talk about race. This is in light of New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees saying he's opposed to kneeling during the national anthem. After being heavily criticized, he's apologized several times. In addition, a longtime NBA broadcaster resigned after tweeting "All Lives Matter." He says he didn't know the phrase was considered dismissive to the concerns of Black Americans. Tina Harris is our guest. She's a professor and endowed chair of race, media, and cultural literacy in the Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. What do you think? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Do Americans need an education on how to talk constructively about race? And how do you feel political correctness has affected the conversation? Has it made it better, harder? We want to hear your thoughts. And have recent events made you feel more or less likely to engage in conversations about racial issues? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones, and Jeff in Green Bay is up. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that I think that, as was stated, actions speak larger than words. And my understanding of his apology, that does fit more with his actions. After Katrina, I know that he was raised money for New Orleans. And throughout his career, he's been very vocal and on the side of helping the community out. And so I believe in his heart, he didn't mean to offend anyone when he said that, when he equated kneeling with lack of patriotism. And that's why the conversation needs to go forward to educate him that the kneeling wasn't about being anti-patriotic. It's the kneeling is showing that, hey, America's not living up to what they say they do. And
thanks for that call, Jeff. And I want to bring on a different perspective there. Let's go to Jill calling from Boyd. Hi, Jill.
Hi. My comment is that I feel like kneeling is an act of reverence. Catholics have been kneeling for centuries as an act of reverence and that type of thing. I feel like if Mr. Kaepernick and others who have knelt in protest would have sat down or stood up and turned their backs, then I would have seen that as being very disrespectful. But I do not feel like kneeling is not, well, it's not a sign of disrespect. I guess that's all I need to say.
Great. Thank you for that call, Jill. And Tina, hearing from different sides of this issue, I think it really shows that there's a big gap in how different people are viewing different parts of this issue. And that alone makes it very difficult to discuss. How do we talk about these issues of race in a constructive way?
Yeah, it does make it very difficult in that you have people who are coming from different backgrounds, different worldviews, and different experiences who, you know, ultimately might either agree to disagree or they choose to not talk about the issues at all. And I think that it is imperative that we have one-on-one conversations with each other to understand exactly what racism is and how that's impacting all of us. A couple of weeks ago, one of my students here at LSU emailed me, and she said that she was having a conversation with her family and wanted to know how she could better explain to them what she had been learning in my class that could help them understand, you know, why people were in the streets, you know, protesting, and ultimately not all of them, but some, you know, were looting. And eventually I just sat down, took a few minutes, and I developed a metaphor, which I think now it has like 3,000, close to 4,000 views. And I used the metaphor of African-Americans, or at the time Africans, when they were enslaved, were essentially in a forced marriage with the U.S. And she being African-Americans, are like a woman who has been abused. She's been crying out, and nothing has happened. No one has come to her rescue. No one has come to protect her. And people, as a result, are lashing out of the depths of their souls. And so that has been a catalyst to help people talk across platforms. I've seen people posting and tagging friends and family on their Facebook pages, and they're even taking the video that I've created to go along with that, you know, to their families, saying, hey, let's talk about this from this perspective. And so I'm sorry it took so long to describe what happened, but I think it's important because it shows us that, you know, we need to think about, we need to be creative in how we are talking to each other about race issues and race relations, because that's the only way we can make a difference and have understanding, is through interpersonal communication. We have to, you know, be honest with ourselves and be truthful about what racism is, and that there's a power dynamic. There is systemic racism that exists in not just the U.S. but elsewhere. But right now we're talking about the U.S. and it's important for us to recognize the power dimensions and how that's affecting groups differently, and some more severely than others.
We're talking right now with Tina Harris. She's a professor and endowed chair of race, media, and cultural literacy at Louisiana State University. And we are talking about some recent events that have been controversial comments made by high profile people, in many cases in the sports arena, and the ensuing reactions and often apologies by the people who said them. And I want to also touch on the situation also last week. Lots been going on lately. The longtime radio play-by-play announcer for the Sacramento Kings, Grant Napier, resigned for tweeting "All Lives Matter." And I want to go back to the phones, and Julie in Platteville is up with a comment about that. Julie, hi.
Hi. I just want to say, I'm an old white lady, and my feeling on this, it just, since, I guess, Trayvon Martin, I've just been getting more and more heartbroken and more angry. I don't understand why this is going on. I mean, of course, all lives should matter, but until every black life matters as much as every white life, all lives clearly do not matter, at least not to the people they should matter to.
Thank you so much for that call, Julie. And Tina, I've seen a lot of different analogies going around about why saying all lives matter can be seen as very offensive and dismissive to people who are advocating for Black Lives Matter. Can you help us unpack that a little bit?
Yes. So when people are saying that Black Lives Matter, it is the purpose and goal of just drawing attention to the fact that that blacks are disproportionately, you know, killed at the hands of police at a much higher rate than whites are. And some people might say, oh, well, the numbers might be the same, or they're quite similar, or we're talking about black on black crime. That's not the case at all. It means that, you know, black people are targeted at a much higher rate. No one should be targeted, but that's what's going on here. And so by saying that Black Lives Matter, it's a cry to recognize that we are important just like everybody else. And it doesn't mean that Black lives are better than or more valuable than anybody else's. Yes, all human lives matter. But the purpose and goal, you know, is to bring attention to the fact that Black lives are not treating, they're not being treated as if they have any value at all. And so it's almost like African Americans can be dispensed of, you know, at the drop of a hat. I mean, and we see that it's going on in the, you know, in the news. So it's important for people. And I want to thank the woman who was just on and had made the comment. I could hear the pain in her voice, and that's what a lot of people are feeling: is that Black lives do matter, and people are misconstruing that and thinking that, you know, we're saying that all other lives are less valuable or less important, or that we are, African Americans, are much more important. And that's not the case at all. Everyone deserves the right to live. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case for all African Americans.
This might be a difficult question to answer, but if we are trying to genuinely engage in conversations about race, and mm-hmm. we may say something that unknowingly does not land with the intention that we have, when and how should we apologize for something we may have said?
I think that an apology would be due, you know, immediately, or as soon as a person recognizes that they were offensive to someone. There are two concepts that my colleague and I talk about in our textbook on interracial communication, and they are emotionality and intentionality. So when you are interacting with someone of a different race, sometimes those conversations can be difficult, and it's important to recognize that there are two different ways that a person can interpret a message. If it's intentionality, you can look at the intention of the person. So that person might say, oh my goodness, I never intended to offend you. And if that's communicated and it seems like it's genuine, and then a person can say, okay, well, they didn't intend to offend me, I can forgive them, and we can move forward in our relationship. But then we can look at the flip side, which is emotionality, where a person has, you know, made a comment, they've said something that's offensive to, you know, their friend or their colleague, and they can apologize. But when we talk about emotionality, you're focused on the emotion, like how that person felt as a result of what was being said to them. So it's important for us to, you know, really take into consideration comments that are being made to someone who's not in the same racial group as you, because those words, you know, can be very hurtful.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much to Tina Harris for joining us. She's a professor of race, media, and cultural literacy at Louisiana State University. We talked with her about recent controversies, about comments coming from several sports figures, and how to have productive but tough conversations about race. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 6, outdoor music is a favorite summer activity in Wisconsin. Host Keely Boltino learns how communities and performers are adapting to conditions this year. That's tomorrow morning at 6, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk with Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers about the secret recordings his staff made during a meeting with top Republican lawmakers. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio delivers essential news, thought-provoking conversations, and music that inspires to hundreds of thousands of listeners, but not without the generous support of our donors. Consider WPR when you plan your philanthropic giving. Your gift makes a difference in our communities every day. Visit WPR.org/donate. Thank you.
PBS Wisconsin is proud to offer Bright by Text, a free texting service for parents and caregivers of children ages 8 and younger. Text the word BADGER to 274-448 and receive research-based, age-specific resources and activities from trusted content partners like PBS Kids. Get free educational resources delivered to your phone with Bright by Text from PBS Wisconsin. Just text BADGER to 274-448.
Live from NPR News, I'm Jack Speer. President Donald Trump is in Dallas today for his first in-person visit since the pandemic forced lockdowns across the country. As KERA's